What's up? It's Andy Grammer with Jag.
Hi, this is Carly Rae Jepsen, and you're listening to Jag.
Hey, everybody, it's Joe Jonas hanging with Jag.
This is Heather Knox, Playboy's Miss January 2012.
With the hottest Jag I've ever seen.
It's B.O.B. checking in with my homie Jag. So much swag with my homie Jag.
It's the Jag Show podcast.
And welcome to episode number 2 of the Jag Show. There's a little hamlet called Burlington, Vermont. It's way up in northern New England. It's Bernie Sanders country. It's pretty left politically, pretty politically correct, with the exception of this one radio station whose call letters are WXXX, and the station is appropriately named 95XXX. It is where I worked with today's guest, Jamie Scavato. Welcome in, Jamie.
Hey, buddy.
And before we even worked there, we worked way back in the spring of 1999 when you were the morning show host on Z89 in Syracuse. You were a senior, I was a freshman. Once a week, I had to come in and do whatever it was you told me to do.
And, you know, it's funny, like your whole career now, you can blame it on me for if anything went wrong along the way.
There have been a few bumps along the road, but there have been a few bumps along the road for both of us. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Jamie today is I've talked to so many people in and out of radio and TV that have struggled with this idea of, you know, this is what I've done for all my adult life, but the radio and TV industries are not great right now. What am I going to do? Do I get out? Is it hard? How do I do it? And Jamie has been to hell and back, basically. You've really been all over the place with everything. So I kind of wanted to take people through your journey as far as, you know, you're starting out on 95XXX in Vermont and kind of the stops along the way and leading up to what you're doing now, which is some pretty incredible stuff.
Yeah, and even before 95XXX, things were weird. When I was at HMP, then became WLZX, and Northampton, and then Springfield, Massachusetts, too. And so that was also an odd chapter that led to me, after going to Syracuse, actually going to the Connecticut School of Broadcasting because my mom made me. My career wasn't going anywhere. And she said, they'll place you in a job. I'm like, Mom, I have a broadcasting degree. But anyway, that is what it is.
So you end up going to the small market, you go to Connecticut School of Broadcasting, and then you end up in Burlington at 95XXX at this dominant radio station in the market on a dominant heritage morning show that's been on the air for, at that point, probably what, 15 or so years before you got there?
Yeah, about 13 or 14 years when I got there, yeah.
And you went in and did the proverbial paying your dues thing, right?
Yeah, and what was interesting about that is that I didn't know that that's what it was one of those things where, I mean, you know, the guy we worked for, he would like tab you the first time he heard you as like the thing that he wanted you to be, but he wouldn't tell you.
Yes.
That's what you're going to be. So when I was just hired to do like some weekends and like work around the office and like figure out a way to get 40 hours and do like promotions and stuff. And then, then it kind of evolved into, hey man, why don't you go out and do this thing? And they gave me an air horn and made me go to the bagel shop and like blow an air horn in there. It's like, oh man, that was funny. Do it again tomorrow. Like, what? And so it just kind of like snowballed from there. And I had no idea that I was going to end up in the role as the station stunt boy, so to speak.
So you do the stunt boy thing for a couple of years. And one thing that you need to know about Jamie is, and all of us have seen some incredibly talented people in this business, Jamie is hands down the very best writer I've ever met in my entire life. And this came true when you started dabbling in TV, right?
Yeah, no, when I worked, yeah, that was an interesting transition. That's a long story of how I got into TV. It was like a 2.5 year process of teaching myself how to be a sports, you know, basically be a sports anchor and a reporter, and altering my face and my physique in order to sort of fit the television mold as well. But yeah, no, a lot of that writing came through and what I did. And then obviously teaching script writing too, like that's further down the line though.
So you're writing some of the material and you're writing some of the bits for the morning show as the stunt guy, but kind of writing the whole thing and setting it all up. And then you transition that into TV. And then at some point you went full time from radio into TV, right?
Yep. Yeah. No, I went over to the NBC affiliate here doing the weekend, you know, weekend sports. I was out shooting most of the week, reporting on stories and then anchoring on the weekends. And then did that for 2 years and went down to Richmond, Virginia to the NBC affiliate there.
So is it fair to say some people in Burlington, Vermont / Plattsburgh, New York knew you as the radio show stunt guy and then some knew you as the sports anchor, or was it more one or the other?
It was definitely the former over the latter. Yeah. It was all, and even now it's like my time on television here, it's like it never happened. So I still hear about probably things that happened 15 years ago, maybe at least once every other day at some point.
That often still.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Doing the TV thing in Plattsburgh, New York. So you get the call to go to a bigger market. What happens next?
I went down to Richmond, Virginia to WWBT, the NBC affiliate. That was a powerhouse station. And God, I was like surrounded. Like, I remember the first day I got there and seeing the reporters and like being around the other anchors who were my age. And these are people that are probably been in the business at this point, like 8 or 9 years. And I've been in it too, because I got a late start and I did it myself. So I was like kind of a DIY dude in that respect. And I just remember looking around, I'm like, oh my God, these guys are really good. And a lot of those people are like national. You have Ed Rod Cassamy in Detroit, was a co-worker of mine down in Richmond.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Oh yeah. He used to talk to me about radio all the time. The dude like, he's an R&B singer and he's an awesome guy. He's like the nicest dude.
You get that impression seeing him on TV. Yeah.
Yeah, we used to be in like the green room together and he just wanted to start talking about being a radio DJ. And I'm like, dude, you're anchoring the news, man. Like, what is wrong with you?
Why would you want to take a step back like that?
Right, exactly. It's like talking to a caveman being like, hey, man, how'd you get that beard so good? It's like, what, brother? It's like, come on, man. But yeah, I know a lot of people I know that are working at CNN now that I work with down there and in DC and basically in big markets all around the country. These were all really, really talented people. So I was lucky to be there, to be honest with you.
So you're there for a little while. Now, meanwhile, I'm at 95XXX at the radio station, and through my long series of events, have become the night guy there. The morning show main host, who had been doing it at that point for 17 years, decides he's got some stuff going on and he wants to leave. And so the boss that we mentioned before, we kind of all sat down and he said, well, we got to call Jamie because the audience knows Jamie. He was a part of the show for a long time. We got to bring him back to be the host. And you were in a position at that time where I think you wanted to make a move, right?
It depends what you call making a move. My personal life, not my professional life, that was actually fine. I just signed a new contract and things were going well. My personal life, I'd gone in the absolute toilet because I was going through a divorce. Mm-hmm. And I didn't handle that particularly well. So it was like things were going, they were pretty haywire. And so I needed to get the hell out of that location. And the only thing I wanted to do was actually come back to Vermont, because for me, this kind of became home. So
you really did fall in love with Burlington, didn't you?
Yeah, you could say that. But it's just a place my roots ended up getting dug. I was here for a while before I left the first time. And I just got ingrained in the community. And it's, for me, I thought of this place as home over my actual hometown. Mm-hmm. So when it came to like wanting to get out of Richmond, it was like I wanted to go home somewhere where I'd be safe and where I knew I'd be surrounded by friends and I'd feel better about life if I was going to start over again. And so this is where I gravitated. And it just so happens that I got the phone call that I got and I was like, yup, I'll come home.
So you come home and you're now the host of the morning show. You're the lead guy. I'm at their same time doing nights. And then over the course of the next few years, you realize it's not what you want to be doing long term.
Didn't take long for me to realize it wasn't what I wanted to do long term. Because it was like all of those things that made me want to leave, like just started. It's one of those things where you think something's going to be different the second time around.
In hindsight, was it an ego thing? Like, okay, I'm no longer the stunt guy. I'm the main host. I'm in a different role now. Or was it just
For me, I know there's a lot of ego in this business. And that's one thing I pride myself on is that I know people always accuse me of being like that, but I never actually was. Like, I had this reputation for being a guy with a big ego, yet I never did anything that people with big egos do. Like for me, like I didn't want to walk into a place and for people to go, oh man, it's Jamie Scovato. Like I never was like that.
Right.
I wanted people to see me and go, oh man, Jamie's good at that thing he likes to do. And that's what I wanted to be known as, being good. I didn't care about having my name out there.
That's where you and I were different. I wanted to have it be like Cheers. I'd walk into a bar and everybody'd be like, Jag!
Yeah, I didn't care. Like if I dealt with that when I was out, I would leave places when that would happen. Like when people if people wanted to talk to me about the show and like they're like, oh man, I like that thing you did when we were talking about that stuff, I was excited. Yeah. When it was like, oh man, stunts, phone scams, I'd be like, Chad, this sucks. you know, and I'd leave wherever I was hanging out. But so, you know, that is what it is.
So that kind of leads me into my next thing. So you're looking to make a move out of radio, but at this point, you've been typecast as the guy in the morning show that did the crazy stunts, some of which definitely pushed the envelope more than others, you know, as the station was known to do to push the envelope. So can you tell me a little bit about the struggle there of what you ran into when you're a 30-something adult male wanting to change careers, and because of the station's success, it worked to your detriment because people heard your name and saw the name of the radio station and, like I said, typecast you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I tried to get employed. Well, at first I tried getting another radio job, and you've heard my air check tapes. That was one thing in this business that I sucked at. Like, I was good at working, but I sucked at marketing myself. So I was terrible at getting a job in radio. So nobody picked me up, even though I knew that I was good enough. I saw people that I'm like, dude, I'm twice as good as that guy.
But right,
you know, they're getting scooped up and I'm just kind of floating around. There was that end of it. And then I tried to get jobs locally just to get out of the business altogether. But what I often came across, and I'd come across it the couple times that I had interviews or when I talked to people, is that I would get maybe 30 seconds into a job interview and it was all about the radio station. They wanted to know about like stuff from 10 years ago. You know, I even had one potential employer kind of on my way out the door. And he said something to me like, oh man, the next time I need a phone scam, I'll get a hold of you. And I was like, are you serious, bro?
I'm
like,
that's just insulting.
Yeah, it was. What will happen is a lot of people didn't see me as a human being. They would see me as this sort of cartoon character whose sole purpose in this life was to be sort of a punching bag for other people. And so they would see my name on the resume and they wouldn't read any further. They wouldn't read about my college credentials. They wouldn't read about my television experience. They wouldn't read about any of the other things that I'm trained to do. They would see the name, they would think one thing, and they would throw the resume away. Or they would call me up so they could bring me in and have a conversation about the job I was trying to leave.
So, Jamie, what do you do in a situation? I mean, I can't imagine how frustrating it is, but like, is do you attempt to try to steer it back to the job interview and about the job and about your resume? Or is it like a lost cause at that point? You say, okay, you want to hear the behind the scenes at the radio station. All right, I'll tell you how we came up with this phone scam.
Yeah, I would. I just roll with it. You know, because I didn't want to push back on somebody in a job interview like that or in any kind of professional situation. Because it's like, you know, if I push back, then suddenly I'm that guy that, because I've noticed one thing that happens and it's tough to break. And I think finally over a few years, I'm starting to break that from people is that when they have a concept of who you are, like an avatar in their brain of what you are.
Right.
And that thing is associated with positive memories of like, you know, whatever, 10, 15 years ago.
Laughing in the car, yeah.
Right. If you say to them that their positive memories are bad memories for you, you're breaking something that is positive for them. So then suddenly they will turn on you as if you kicked a puppy, you know, or as if you just told them that Santa Claus isn't real. Like that's kind of the reaction that I would get.
The psychology of that is fascinating, yet at the same time, it makes total sense.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, people hold on to, especially memories from a certain like sort of chapter in their life. And I was there at a time when sort of the magnitude of the popularity of that product was close to its height. It was probably the beginning of the decline because the height was probably right, like the peak was right before I got there. Like the psychology of it is something that I'm better at understanding now. But it doesn't make it any more enjoyable to have to deal with it.
Having been in the situation, would you have advice for somebody who is, say, a TV producer or a radio personality, and they go into a job interview for, say, a marketing or a PR job, and the person across the desk says to them, oh, well, wow, like, what was it like to be on the radio? What was it like to be on TV? Or what was it like to meet famous celebrities? I mean, how would you advise someone else to handle that situation, now having been through it yourself?
It's tough to answer that, because I think for me it was particularly unique. Because or as my wife likes to tell me, the mistake that I made, even though I like my name, was that using my real name was the biggest mistake of all, because not only because people would recognize it, but because people would make that connection instantly. So they'd see the name or they would hear the name out loud and they would immediately, it would jog all of those memories and all those thoughts as to what they thought I was, even though, you know, it was a caricature of myself. It was semi-truthful, but most of what I did at that radio station was based on an act, but the act had the same name as the real person. So I think that is where things got dicey for me. And my wife's smarter than I am, so I will I'll give her credit where credit's due.
I know the feeling. So it's a tough spot to be in, and you're getting frustrated. I remember talking to you as you were going through some of this, and I felt for you because it was frustrating. So how did you finally make the move out into what did you end up doing?
Well, I quit. No, I started teach. I met somebody in Plattsburgh who was she was at the time the head of the communications department at Plattsburgh State. She kind of got me involved with adjuncting there. And when she saw my resume, there's a definite line between two types of people that I've met since coming back here. There's the people that listen to the show and there's the people that don't. She was one of the people that don't.
Fortunately.
So, yeah, she didn't understand what the hubbub was about. She just saw, oh, wow, you worked at Channel 5 up the street. Oh, wow, you worked at the NBC in Richmond. Oh, wow, you know, you've been in broadcasting for 15 years. And so she gave me a chance to, oh, and you have a Syracuse degree. And it was right. Like, she gave me a chance to teach a script writing class, narrative script writing class, which I modeled after. I don't know if, did you ever have Evan Smith at Syracuse, Professor Smith?
I did not, know.
He was basically one of my favorite classes that I had there. And the way he taught his script writing class was I kind of modeled it after his, and it was really successful. And she told me, she's like, you know, you could do this. You can teach full time if you want to. You sort of have that ability to work with students and they seem to think you're a rock star. And I'm like, cool. I don't get my ego struck very often. So that was nice. So with that, I ended up pursuing teaching. And so I got more adjunct opportunities through Plattsburgh. Some of those kind of washed away when a new person took over the department and that person had listened to the show. And so suddenly I was a completely different asset or lack thereof to the faculty.
I can't imagine that, Jamie. So you finally find somebody that's going to see past this, you know, character you were on the air. You get the opportunity and then another big boss comes in and you're essentially back to square one.
Yeah, no, it was exactly how it was. And that happened after I left the radio station to go back to grad school full time, which is what I'm finishing up in a couple of weeks here. But I mean, while that was going on, I also got back into sports doing play-by-play too for sort of a small company that's out in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. And for those of you people who don't know, that's the Sticks, basically. It's 2 hours away from Burlington. And that guy also had no idea. He just knew I was on the radio and I wanted to run camera and do production for him because I didn't think anything of doing play-by-play. I'd never done it. And he said, well, you're on the radio. You'll figure it out. Go do some play-by-play. So I've been doing that for about 5 years now.
And sports has always been such a passion of yours. So that's got to be a great outlet for you.
And it was awesome because this was an issue. This was a situation where, I mean, the money isn't great. It's freelance and it's low-level freelance. But I had so much fun doing it. Like an unbelievable amount of fun doing it. And it was no pressure. So I could screw up. I could have a game where I suck. But I would go back and I would, you know, try and improve every step of the way. And I've gotten to the point now, after doing it for about 5 years, where I'm actually pretty good at it. I mean, I don't think I'll be showing up on ESPN anytime soon. But for me, doing play-by-play is like a hobby that gets me a little bit of money every now and again. And I don't know what I'd do without it. So I got to go on those two avenues when I got away from the radio station. So I'm still, my toes are still in the water of broadcasting. I teach it now. I teach production. At a college here in Burlington. I'm also still on the air somewhat as a play-by-play announcer. So that kind of kept me in the game a little bit.
I mean, that's kind of how I feel a little bit, you know, not being on the radio full-time anymore. Doing the podcast thing for me fulfills a Jones for me in doing a radio show. And then also working for Quizzo and doing bar trivia nights kind of fulfills that crowd interaction piece of it that I miss as well. So I think it's a matter of finding something that might be a little bit outside the box of that sort of satisfied that piece of your brain, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, my advice for anyone who wants to get out of the business is to get a job.
Like just, get a real grown-up job.
Yeah, get a grown-up job. Just do what everyone else is doing. And if you're not a known commodity in your community, people will more likely look at your broadcast experience as a positive rather than a negative. But again, it all depends on where you were and what you did and on what your other skills are. Like, if you need to build skills on something, I know for me, like right now I'm doing a lot of programming, not radio programming, but programming. Mm-hmm. And that's a skill that is transferable anywhere. So if you start, I mean, go to YouTube University, man, and start picking up some of those skills that are important in the job market. So if people ask you when you're on an interview, if you know how to do something, you know how to do it. Like, learn how to do as much stuff as you can. And you don't need a graduate degree to do that. I'm in grad school because I want to teach full time. So I can't teach without at least a terminal degree, which is what I'll be finishing up here in a little bit. But that's the biggest thing that I could say is that, like, it's not so bad having a regular job. It ain't 9 to 5. You know, people talk about how much it sucks, but it doesn't suck at 5 when you go home and you're done and you can, like,
well, you look at your schedule over the years, you know, doing a morning show, getting up at 3-4 in the morning, or doing TV sports at night, not getting out of work until midnight. So 9 to 5 for you has got to be like a dream.
No, that would be a nightmare. It's still a nightmare for me.
Okay, okay.
My body doesn't want to do that. And I'm not normal. Like, thing is, I can't do what normal people do. I'm not a normal person. For me, it's always going to be hard to fit in sort of the, quote, adult world. You know, it runs my family. My father is the same way. He hasn't had a job, really. He's never had an employee and he's never had an employer in 60 years.
Wow. So
that's just kind of the way I am too. I never minded getting up at the crack of dawn, and I didn't mind getting out of work late. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon that I hated most, actually.
So what is the degree that you're going for at this point?
It's a Masters of Fine Arts. So it's an MFA, like an MBA.
Okay.
And it's in emergent media, which is essentially, or as I like to call it, future stuff. Where it's basically a little bit of everything that is happening now in terms of business, technology, the arts. It's sort of the infusion of all those things, because that is happening now wherever you go. You know, art is coming together with technology. Technology is coming together with all sorts of other things. I mean, obviously everything is tech, but it's just the way sort of things are becoming more congealed. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of leave, basically I'm leaving this thing as a jack of all trades, but a master in none. But it also makes me eligible to teach full time at the college level, which is what I want to do. And with sort of the side skills and sort of the broader philosophies on different things that I'm coming away with it, I'm definitely coming away a smarter person than I was going in. And I would say a more valuable person, even if I had to get back out of the regular job market as well.
So you're working on a thesis at this point?
Yeah, that's all I'm doing.
Can you tell us what the thesis is about?
I'm taking a data analytic approach to popular culture.
Okay.
And being in radio, pop culture's always kind of been a thing of mine. And when I was at Syracuse, we had Professor Bob Thompson, who
is on every Good Morning America, Today right. show, you know, when there's a pop culture moment. Yeah.
Right. And for people listening to this who don't know, or one point in time, he was one of 6 people in the world who had a PhD in popular culture studies. It was at a time when people were sort of frowning on it. Nowadays, there are hundreds of people mm-hmm. who study this subject in depth. I'm taking it from a different angle, which I didn't even know this was like an emerging field. It's called computational anthropology.
Wow.
And what it does is it takes data and it relates that data or correlates that data to anthropological studies. Popular culture falls under the umbrella of cultural anthropology. It's just kind of a fluffier version of it. But basically what I do is I looked at the Billboard Hot 100 and I wrote a program that sort of compiled all of those charts. And with those numbers, I inserted a bunch of genre, subgenre, a bunch of other biographical categories, gender, ethnicity, and things like that. And I'm running them through some sort of data analytics libraries that I'm programming myself. And I'm looking at the trends that happen over time. And then I'm correlating those trends to things that were happening historically at that time.
Wow.
So basically what I'm calling it is, it's a lot of line graphs. It's called Scavato's Billboard Fiasco. That's the name of the exhibit. And it's going to be an exhibit in a couple of weeks, an interactive sort of audiovisual kind of deal. And the tagline is, where there's a spike, there's a story. So
I like that.
Yeah. If I was taking a look at subgenres, for example, in the late 1950s, and it's still to this day the biggest spike in cultural shift musically, it's the birth of rock and roll. Like, before that, there was nothing that was anything like it. That was in the popular nomenclature. I mean, obviously it existed in the black community, and then white people stole it and it became this explosion. but it's following trends like that. Like, the most interesting one right now that's happening, and it's actually the biggest spike in activity in terms of appearances by this one subgenre on the chart, and that's trap music. It's actually the biggest spike in activity since disco. Kid you not.
That just depresses me. This is why I'm not a top 40 DJ anymore.
Yeah. And then there's other fluctuations too. Like, there's if you look at the early 80s, there's this unbelievable drop off right around 1981. You can see where I'm going with this. Right around 1981, where like soft rock, country pop at the time, like Kenny Rogers and stuff like that, course, then you had like, you know, your soft rock with like Anne Murray and Hall & Oates. Well, Anne Murray's more country too. Disco disappeared, funk disappeared. And then at the same time, there was a explosion of synth pop, new wave, dance pop. Later on, it was New Jack Swing, which then led into, you know, the popularity of hip hop and pop rap. And then that this trade-off where everything that was current disappeared and everything that was left was new was right at the same time where MTV came into play.
Right. So
visually, through the sort of the analysis of this data, an actual cultural shift taking place. And that's kind of what the whole thesis is about. That was a long-winded way of describing it, but that's kind of what it is.
Well, no, as a former radio DJ, I find that fascinating. I think my listeners would too. And so you talk about the shift with MTV and Video Killed the Radio Star and that whole idea and how we started watching music instead of just listening to it. Have you seen any kind of a similar shift with the advent of either just the internet itself or how much people are sharing and streaming music over the last several years?
A little bit at the turn of the decade. There are two really pivotal moments that I've noticed a shift in. And one is in the late 1990s, because the 1990s, when it comes to the Billboard Hot 100, are kind of like a black hole. And you may remember times being like this, where it was like you were either a mainstream music person or you were a modern rock person. And they were two different worlds.
That speaks to what happened at our college radio station in the mid to late 90s, where they blew up the top 40, made it rock or alternative. And a couple of years, they changed it back.
Right. And what people need to know about the Billboard Hot 100 is, or any of the Billboard charts, is they're not for people. They're not for the audience. They're actually for the industry. They were created for the industry to keep track of what was happening in the music industry so they knew what was popular and what wasn't. And they're constantly changing the way they calculate things, the way they do algorithms. And in the case of the 90s, any song that wasn't sold as a physical single was not eligible for the Billboard Hot 100. Therefore, it never made top 40, so to speak. Songs like No Doubts Don't Speak, Green Day's When I Come Around, anything by Bush.
And those were all huge songs, thinking back. So they were not on the Billboard chart because they couldn't be sold as singles despite getting a ton of radio airplay.
Right. So they were album cuts. So that also created this divide with modern rock. When modern rock became a format in, you know, the mid to late 1990s, or now it's called alternative, most of those songs were album cuts. So they never made the jump to the Hot 100. So there's this weird divide when you look at radio airplay and you look at album sales and then you look at what was actually going on in terms of what was considered a hit record. There's this huge divide. And that divide kind of took place culturally. In 1998, they changed that. And then you get to the early 2000s where everything sort of started congealing. And you can see that in the data that I've got collected as well. You see all of these sort of trends and lines, and next thing you know, they all started blending in the middle, and that carried throughout with occasional bumps here and there with genres. Like 2013, you had the bro country bump, and then there was another year where you had, you know, the pop rap bump, and then there was this bump, the crunk bump in the late 2000s.
That was my time doing nights at 95XXX. I remember that part well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So all of this stuff just kind of congealed where music became really corporate. It all started sounding very produced. Mm-hmm. Very palatable. And then out of nowhere, last year, trap shows up, which was almost seemed like, I don't know how this ended up happening. And I'd have to look at the correlations that take place. But to me, it almost seemed like young people were just sick of corporate garbage. And to them, trap music sounded like anything but. So it seemed like something they could grab onto, something they could own, almost similar to the early 90s rock explosion, where it was like people got sick of hair bands, and so Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Smashing Pumpkins and all these bands showed up, and then people are when we were teenagers then could go like, yeah, F you to the generation
but,
before.
But even like they did with rock and roll in the 60s, the same concept, right?
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying trap music is that's what's interesting and unique about this, is that trap music is nothing new. 5-10 years ago, it was called Southern Hip Hop.
Right.
It's very similar to crunk. What's weird is that it's had as much of an impact as it had, being that it's an offshoot of something that was already established, well established. But it's, if I could show you the graphic depiction of the absolute takeover that it's had, it's fascinating. And it's still trending upward. It's not done. I haven't gone into 2018 yet. My study ends at the end of 2017. At the end of 2017, it's still trending up. So it's still probably got another 6 months to go. and then something really, really white is going to come along.
The theory was always that there is a 9-year cycle to top 40. Have you seen a correlation with that, where it kind of goes, where it kind of vacillates between poppy and rock versus the hip hop side, and sort of a vacillation between those two things? Or is that just kind of an old wives' tale about this cycle of pop music?
No, they switch off. But the thing that happens is whenever something new comes along, once it gets really, really mainstream, and that's when it begins to fade away. But not only does it fade away as a subgenre, it ends up blending in with what's already popular. Like rock and roll as a genre had a quick explosion that lasted about 2 years. But rock music is what came out of it. Pop rock, soft rock, psychedelic rock, you know, beat rock, all these different kinds of rock came out of it. So it's hard to sort of describe anything in sort of a 9-year cycle. I don't know if I necessarily agree with it. I think it's unique unto every decade as to how things go. I can say that the early portion of a decade in year 2 or 3 usually has some kind of pop that has a cultural significance. And then usually in year 7, 8, 9, the antithesis to that starts taking hold and usually has more of an effect.
Which is about where we are right now.
Yep.
Really, really interesting stuff. And it's funny, Jamie, I wanted to talk to you about your journey and how you went from A to Z with all these points in between. And I'm really kind of fascinated to get into this whole discussion of your thesis too, as a former radio guy. I think a lot of radio people listening to this and music geeks, I could think of several off the top of my head that are going to be really interested to hear this. And I'm sure they're going to want to check out your work when it's finished.
Yeah, hopefully it's okay. I'm, you know, not just the trend stuff too. It's the gender and ethnicity stuff this gets into, and even some of the location stuff. There's some very interesting things that come out of it, especially when you look at gender and ethnicity. It's almost hilarious because I have a success metric that's tied to every record based on, you know, how well it performed, not only where it ranked, but in total. And the gap between male and female solo performers is pretty severe. It changed significantly in the late 80s, shocker.
Madonna. With
Madonna, Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey in the early 90s. That brought things closer together. And then it just kind of went all dude again. But if you recalculate it outside of just solely appearances, and you calculate the success metric, it's women may make fewer appearances on the chart overall, but their records tend to last longer and peak higher. So take that for what it's worth.
Jamie, I appreciate you taking the time and being on episode number 2 of the JAG Show. You and I go back almost 20 years now. So it's
we go back 20 years.
Yeah. So
19, 20.
I'm just thrilled to see the success and everything that's coming to you. It's a long time coming. Very happy for you and your wife up there in Vermont. And we'll have to get together soon. I really appreciate the time, brother.
Yeah, man.
And I also want to thank you for listening to episode number 2 of the JAG Show podcast. Really appreciate it. If you want other people to find out about the podcast, feel free to share it. And the best thing you can do is leave a rating. Let us know what you think. Leave a rating, and that will help other people find it. It'll go up in the charts and all that. You can find the JAG Show podcast in Apple Podcasts. You can also now find it on Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, pretty much wherever you find podcasts. So download it in your favorite place, or you can always check them out on my website, jagindetroit.com. It's also where you can find me on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, Jag in Detroit. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.